Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to night two of our special five-part tribute to the Brian De Palma thriller. Tonight, we dive into one of De Palma's biggest hits and one of the most effective horror films ever made, Carrie, with special guests including author and critic John Kenneth Muir and actress Nancy Allen. Coming up next on Movie Geeks United.
It's the night of the senior prom. The Bates High School gym is alive with excitement. Everybody is there, even Carrie White, the girl no one likes.
I'm all sorry about this incident, Cassie.
It's Carrie!
And everyone makes fun of her. The girl who lives in that creepy house with her crazy mother.
The sin of her days and ways. Show her that if she had remained sinless, the curse of blood would never have come on her.
The girl with the strange power.
If I concentrate hard enough, I can move things.
But tonight, no one will laugh at Carrie.
We don't have a date to the prom next Friday. Would you like to go with me?
She's with the best-looking boy in the senior class.
You're trying to trick me.
She'll be voted queen of the prom.
You know, I can make sure that you don't hurt Carrie White anymore.
For Carrie, it will be a dream come true. For everyone else, it will be a nightmare. Carrie. A new film by Brian De Palma. Based on the chilling bestseller. Starring Sissy Spacek, Piper Laurie, and introducing John Travolta in his first motion picture role. If you have a taste for terror, you have a date with Carrie.
Welcome to Movie Geeks United tonight, everybody. My name is Jamie.
And my name is Jerry, and welcome to The Carrie Show.
The Carrie Show. Yeah. You know, it's funny. I have these, our first interview, like our first interviews for all during the week is our good friend John Kenneth Muir. And so I have these files labeled John / Blowout, you know, and tonight's file name is obviously John Carrie. Just to let our live listeners know, if you're trying to get into the chat room, it's down for some reason. We're working on technical support right now to get it up and running again. So hopefully that'll happen before too long. But welcome to night two of our De Palma tribute. Tonight we're going to be discussing Carrie. So here's a little background on Carrie. Following the success of Sisters, Brian De Palma delved into a brave and bold musical film called Phantom of the Paradise, a project that has since gained enormous cult status, as well as a future stage musical and a planned film remake. Obsession, it's one of your favorites, Jerry.
Yes, it is, yes.
Followed soon after. That's a twisted and haunted kind of Hitchcockian love story, which you'll hear a lot more about from producer George Lido during our Dress to Kill special tomorrow night. Which brings us to Carrie, which would become De Palma's biggest success in the 70s. The first film based on a Stephen King novel, Carrie tells the story of outcast Carrie White as she deals with the typical pressures of high school life, like the nasty bullying and the awkward onset of womanhood. But in realizing the details of this world, and aided by his terrific actors including Sissy Spacek, Nancy Allen, John Travolta, Amy Irving, Betty Buckley, Piper Laurie, De Palma creates a completely sympathetic portrait that anyone who ever attended high school would be hard-pressed not to relate to. And then you throw in Carrie's awesome and increasingly terrifying telekinetic powers and an overbearing and fruity mother, and you've got a horror movie classic.
Mm-hmm.
It really did make a big impact on pop culture, and the movie grossed the equivalent of $135 million in today's box office dollars. It was a big hit.
That is.
And its enduring influence is evidenced by the endless allusions to some of the film's most unforgettable sequences, mainly the savage prom scenes where Carrie wreaks havoc on her class after being doused in pig's blood.
Right. Mm-hmm.
And this was interesting. In a poll, I read that in a poll taken in 2008, I don't know who conducted the poll, but Carrie was the most popular film among those surveyed as to which movie they choose to return to on Halloween night. Like, they choose to watch Carrie on Halloween. Not Halloween, but Carrie.
That's
interesting.
Makes a lot of sense, because growing up, I remember when that first came on television. That's when I first watched it. I must have been in the third or fourth grade. This was like the late 70s or the early 80s. But, you know, and everyone always talked about Carrie, the pig's blood and everything. And, you know, kids always talked about it at school. I just remember, you know, Travolta, obviously, because he had Welcome Back, Kotter and everything. So Travolta was a very popular pop culture figure in my high school. Elementary school. And it was just like Carrie was like on the mind and on the lips of everyone, because everyone's older brother or sister took them to go see it at the drive-in or whatever. So it was a very popular film for its day. It still is. I mean, and I think it holds up very well.
Yeah. Just to let everyone know, the chat room is up now. So if you refresh the page or just click on chat now, you'll be able to participate in the chat room and comment on what we're saying here. And just the imagery alone. I mean, that image of Carrie covered in pig's blood, I mean, that's mm-hmm. one of the great iconic 20th century cinematic images.
I agree. I agree 100% with that.
Yeah. And we talk about it a lot in our discussion with John that we'll play in just a bit. Just, this is where you start to see the best of De Palma at work.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we covered Sisters, his first big thriller. Mm-hmm. In Carrie and in the best De Palma films, like Blowout and the other films that we're going to be talking about in this series, De Palma works on several layers. You know, there's several layers of meaning and visual meaning and character development and that kind of thing. There's all kinds of layers going on at once. And so his films are incredibly dense. I mean, they are packed with a lot of stuff to chew on.
Yeah.
And we talk about it in this upcoming interview, and we feature Armand White, our previous interview with Armand White, at the beginning of this upcoming interview, just to illustrate this point and start off a conversation with John. Those different layers and how they pertain to the first scene in Carrie, mm-hmm. in the shower. And, I mean, I won't get into it now because we're about to play the interview, but you'll see that in the best of De Palma, and it's all there in Blowout, and we even discussed it last night with Sisters.
Mm-hmm.
You know, a very shocking, over-the-top kind of thriller, and yet there's real subtext there. And there's subtext in every one of De Palma's movies.
There's a lot, and you speak about many layers. I think it's very true, and it's something as recent as Femme Fatale.
Mm-hmm.
I definitely see a lot of that. Different layers and everything, a lot of different things going on. And there's something else I just wanted to add to from the interview from last night. You know, there are thrillers, and then there are De Palma thrillers. And the thing about De Palma thrillers is that he takes it from an angle you wouldn't normally expect. There's something at first, the first time you watch some of these films, like The Fury or Obsession, there's something so awkward about it, but it's also so welcoming, too. It's just something... You know you're watching a De Palma film after a while. There's something unique about it. You don't see it from anyone else, really. He has, like you said, he's probably the most visual director alive. But
yeah.
It's just unique. I mean, we don't see that often. It's really, I was thinking about it while listening to the interview last night, and it's just like there is no one quite like him. And I know a lot of people would disagree with that. Other film people would disagree with that. But I really think there's something unique about watching the De Palma film.
Yeah, and I completely don't understand those people that would argue against his merits as a one-of-a-kind filmmaker. There's obviously the visual.
Mm-hmm.
That he's 100% through and through a visual storyteller. But these conversations are really centered around the visual, obviously, but they're mostly centered around content,
mm-hmm.
and how De Palma tells a story, and how he uses not only devices like split screen, nonstop tracking shots, that kind of thing, but how he uses the female character. I mean,
right.
Here's another movie, just like Sisters. Here's another movie, very strong female characters that dominate the entire film.
Mm-hmm.
It's really a movie about the power and the fear and the embarrassment and humiliation and all of that of coming into womanhood.
Right.
In a lot of ways.
There's a lot of truth to that. There's definitely, once again, it's a very, there are people who disagree with that, unfortunately, but it's true. It is. It's a great, it's a great coming-of-age film.
Well, yeah, that's what it is.
Yeah, but I mean, that's really what, if you really think about it, and I'm not trying to take away from tonight's show at all. I just went, he was talking about, Tarantino is obviously the name that comes up, and he's probably his biggest defender as far as filmmakers go today.
Right.
And his biggest, but the other name to bring out, and many people disagree with me on this, I would have to say Richard Kelly. You see it in The Box, and you see it in Donnie Darko, and you see it in Southland Tales. There is a definite De Palma lineage there.
Right.
I don't care who you are. It's there. It's there in Donnie Darko, and Donnie Darko owes things to carry. It really does.
I definitely see it in.
Yeah.
And Donnie Darko. And I see it stylistically in The Box.
Yeah. So he's another one. But he's a fascinating figure. We wouldn't be doing all these shows if we didn't believe that. Just a fascinating presence.
Yeah. And, I was thinking tonight about what I just said about the coming into womanhood and the first horror that Carrie experiences when we pick her up at the beginning of the movie is
mm-hmm.
She has her first cycle. She menstruates for the first time in the
right.
shower, and everyone makes fun of her. That's our first taste of the life of the outcast life that she leads and how
mm-hmm.
difficult and humiliating that life is. So by the end, when the movie reaches a fever pitch, you hearken back to when she has blood on her legs and her hands,
mm-hmm.
And everyone's laughing and making fun of her until she loses it at the end when she's completely covered in blood.
Right.
There are like correlations here, it's not like a serious investigation of something. I mean, but it can be enjoyed. What I mean by that is it can be enjoyed as a great scare film.
Mm-hmm.
You know? But there's also so much more, and that's why I love rewatching De Palma movies, because I discover new things all the time. Just talking to John and some of the other guests that we've had on this series,
right.
I'm discovering new things about these films, and they're so much richer to me. And how many movies do that? You know,
not a lot. We said this guy. Even though this was 3 years ago, it feels like it was just yesterday. We did the tribute show and we interviewed him. God, time has really flown by, but it's. He's like sort of like Rodney Dangerfield. And one, he gets no respect. He gets absolutely no respect from people, and it is frustrating because there's just so much to work with. There's so much to examine. There's so much to, even in the smaller films. There's just a lot to really look at, and there is a worldview. There is a Brian De Palma philosophy, if you will,
mm-hmm.
and
mm-hmm.
it's there. As people have written books, there are many books yet to be written about his films, I think. And
Yeah.
Fascinating career so far.
Well, that's why that was my greatest hope, and some of these interviews and our conversations to turn people on to the caliber of films we're talking about here, and that there's a lot more underneath the surface of these films that make them much richer experiences. So let's get to our first interview, and then we'll continue our conversation after.
Cool.
John Kenneth Muir, we're going to start out the show, like every show this week, with his exceptional commentary and analysis on De Palma's films. Tonight, obviously, we're talking about Carrie. And you can read a lot about John Kenneth Muir's books at his website, johnkennethmuir.com, and you can read his film criticism, where I was first turned on to his writing, at his blog, reflectionsonfilmandtelevision.blogspot.com. Here is John telling us all about his thoughts on Carrie.
So many films want to mirror TV. They want to make you feel comfortable and let you know exactly what to feel at what time and where your loyalty should be. And De Palma's films aren't that easy. And talking about Carrie, getting into Carrie, I have a quick clip here that I want to play for you and get your thoughts on it to kind of introduce this notion. We talked to Armand White, and he brought up the opening of Carrie, and I want to get your thoughts on what he has to say here.
That's a particular kind of modernist satire, because it's clearly a reference to Psycho, the shower scene in Psycho, but it's not a dull reference to Psycho.
Not at all.
It's a bemused reference to Psycho, and then even more than that, it's a kind of erotic tease as well, and then even more than that, it gets deeply into the psyche of Carrie, as in her experience of being a pubescent girl and having an awareness of what her blooming sexuality means in the context, in a social context, in fact. It's a very rich sequence, but it's a little scary, it's erotic, and it's also funny.
So could you expand upon that aspect of De Palma's work, the different layers at work?
Right. Well, I think that quote was very smart, and I think it's right on the money. You know, when I look at the way that Carrie opens, it opens like some sort of almost a softcore sex.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it opens as the adolescent sexual fantasy. We move slowly through the locker room, and there's steam. So the image is softened a little. It's romanticized. It's become kind of dreamy. We've got the dreamy music on the soundtrack, and we've got these beautiful bodies. And it's sort of the fantasy of sort of perfect adolescent sexuality. And then, of course, we get to the shower, and it's a very erotic and sensual moment when sort of Carrie is, you know, she's caressing her own body, and it's sort of, you know, it's close shots. We really feel this, you know, the power of adolescent sexuality, you know, that period where you're first aware of sexuality, and it feels like the most important thing in the world, and when you first discover it, the power of it makes you swoon. And De Palma's camera work here, the haze, the slow motion, the bodies, the close shots of, you know, flesh, they contribute to that idea of swooning. And then, of course, comes the menstrual blood and the idea of responsibility in sex comes out of it. The hard reality of sex follows very quickly on the fantasy of sex.
Yeah.
Jenny! Come on, grow up, stand up and take care of yourself.
It's not just that he's depicting there the sort of realities about sex, it's that he's also reflecting, I think, the universality of sort of the American high school experience, which is that we've all had, you know, uncomfortable moments. You know, we've either all been bullied, or we've had some, you know, unfortunate phys ed, you know, locker room experience, or a lot of people have. You know, there's something very universal about that and very cruel. You know, Pauline Kael said that, you know, watching Carrie was like a teenager's dirty joke sustained for 2 hours, something like that. I'm paraphrasing wildly.
Yeah.
It was a quote very much like that. And, you know, and I think that's true. He's getting at a lot of things there. He's getting at the metaphor, you know, of high school, you know, Carrie White burns in hell. Yes, that hell is high school, you know.
Mm-hmm.
There's that idea to it. There's the idea of awakening. There's also, you know, the idea there, you know, in the era of the ERA, you know, very shortly after the Roe v. Wade decision, of a woman reckoning with her own sexual power. I mean, this was not a small thing. I mean, you know, I don't want to reduce, you know, the rights argument on this to superficialities, but the idea is, you know, you don't want a woman to have the pill because she then has sexual power. She can have sex with anybody. You know, there isn't the responsibility associated with sex. And so I also think in Carrie is encapsulated the 70s idea of the fear of the liberated female, of a woman who achieves adulthood, is indoctrinated into the world of sexuality and has, you know, enormous power. And wow, isn't that frightening? You know, but mm-hmm. I think it's a joke on that. I don't think that that's what De Palma is saying, because, I mean, he's a leftist and an anti-establishment, so he's not carrying, you know, the water for the, you know, the sort of repressive rights argument. He's sort of, you know, making a joke of this. You know, it's a metaphor for that. I don't know. You know, you could write a whole essay about that opening scene, because I think so too.
On
so many levels, you know.
Yeah, and it automatically establishes an empathy for Carrie that carries throughout the film. And I think those opening minutes, it tells you everything you need to know about the conflicts of that character. I mean, we talk about the adolescent sexuality, we talk about the menstruation and the fear and the shame and how her classmates respond to it, her outsider status. I mean, it's really incredibly efficient as well as imaginative, that opening couple of minutes.
Absolutely. I mean, and just the idea, and I mean, you have to credit, you know, Stephen King with coming up with the narrative, but you credit Brian De Palma for the way that it comes together, which is that, you know, the idea that the menstrual blood and her psychic power come together. It is like in becoming adults that this double, you know, that this curse or what is it? You know, that's when this lands. You know, it's just mm-hmm. very interesting. I mean, there are just so many ways to read the film, but it's a wonderful opening to a really great 70s horror film. There's no doubt about it.
Yeah. And again, there are strange goings on throughout the film, obviously with the relationship with the mother and the telekinesis aspects of it. But for most of its running time, I've always found that it plays like a John Hughes teen movie. I mean, and so when it goes to absolute hell at the end, I mean, you feel it tenfold. Because you've been kind of lulled into this state of, you know, this is what adolescence, the horror of adolescence, and then it goes to hell.
I couldn't agree with you more. You know, the universality of that experience, you know, just of being somebody who maybe was shy in school, you so empathize with her and you become an advocate for her. Like, oh, you know, I want things to turn out okay for her, you know, and
mm-hmm.
and the thing is that's perfect. This is how horror really works, and De Palma, you know, is very clever to do it this way. That, you know, so we're so focused on that, on our feelings for her. She's shy. Look how pretty she looks, all dressed up. You know, this could change everything. You know, we're thinking about all of these almost soap opera things, you know, and we're totally consumed by them, because Sissy Spacek is such a wonderful performer and projects such innocence and sweetness in that role, you know. So we're really looking at this sort of little micro state of Carrie, and then it goes to this other thing. I mean, and if you look at how the prom scene starts, it starts out like some kind of adolescent fantasy. She had no expectation to win prom queen, and you get up and they circle and they dance, and she's dancing with William Catt, and they look into each other's eyes, and it's the slow motion again, and it's like, oh my gosh, it is. You're like watching a teen, romance, and the thing is, it doesn't come off as cliche. You're totally swept up in it. And then of course, the horror lands on you again, and it's shocking and horrible. And then it asks you to really contextualize Carrie for what she did, because she even takes down her coach, who was kind to her, Betty Buckley. Mm-hmm. She even sort of blasts her with a psychic wave during that, the scene in the prom there. And then you have to ask yourself, you've invested so strongly in this girl, and now look what she's doing,
Yeah.
I think it's very interesting. I think horror movies really get to some kind of core, value when you're like sympathizing with the monster, but also saying, I wish she hadn't done that. If she hadn't done that, I still would have been with her, because those girls deserved it. But Betty Buckley didn't deserve it. You're sympathizing with the monster, in a way, in a very powerful way.
It's those conflicted loyalties again, that
right.
creep up in his work. I guess this is a good time to talk about his work with actors and the kinds of performances he pulls out of them, because Sissy Spacek, which is almost unheard of for this kind of movie, she got an Oscar nomination for this film. And then you have Piper Laurie, who was just given free rein to be as bold as she wanted to and really find the humor in that character. Where do you see the performance level that he gets from actors?
I think it's a high level. I mean, I think he always does extremely well with actors, but I think... the core to understanding about De Palma is that the actors are another part of the language that he's using. It's another piece of film, another piece of film language. And so he knows how to deploy them to their best advantage, I think.
Mm-hmm.
Very rarely is there a bummer of a performance in a De Palma film. I really liked Redacted, but Redacted being a different sort of, it was a different aesthetic, where it was really trying to ape very much, concrete our consensus reality. It was with the handheld cams and the different media, which was very courageous and interesting. But the performance, it's very hard even for the best actors to like somehow make it seem like absolutely concrete, real. You know what I'm saying?
Mm-hmm.
So that would be the only thing I'd say. Some of the performances were wavery, but. I just think that, the thing about De Palma is that you can't really point to any area where he doesn't deploy, the aspect of film that he's using in a powerful and meaningful way. And, it goes down to people who aren't usually mentioned. I mean, like William Catt. I think William Catt is great in that movie. It's a small part, but he nails it,
Mm-hmm.
It's not a showy part, but he just does great with this curly-haired, happy-go-lucky guy,
Yeah.
His girlfriend asked him to do something. He thinks, well, why am I doing it? She says, just do it. He says, okay, And but you feel like he likes Carrie, too,
Mm-hmm.
It's very interesting. But again, it's the conflict you talk about. We don't ever know exactly how he feels about it. He does it. But why? But it's such an interesting performance that you believe this guy would just do that. I mean, how many guys would do that who are, they're dating the most popular girl, and she says, take the girl everybody hates to the prom? Okay.
Yeah.
Sure.
He has no worries. He has no problems in life, that guy.
Right. Exactly. It's just a very interesting performance. And there's something. I mean, because I'm sure he was probably in his 20s. I don't know if we could look on the IMDb or something. But he projects some kind of, like Sissy Spacek, some sort of essential quality of youth very accurately. I think he comes across as very naive and sort of not beaten down by the world. He comes through as some sort of kind of innocent, which is like really, really different from how John Travolta's character and Nancy Allen's character are portrayed. I mean, they're just like the most awful people you've ever encountered. But the thing is, they're not cartoons. I mean, we all know people who were like that in high school, unfortunately. It's not a cartoon.
Hi, Carrie.
Hi.
So this is where you live, huh?
What are you doing here?
You can ask me. Why not?
Mama's resting.
Oh.
What?
God, right to the point. About the prom again.
I already told you.
Well, I know, but there's nothing to say you can't change your mind. Girls do it all the time.
Why are you doing this?
Because I want to.
No, you're not.
Gary, now come on. I don't do anything I just want.
I can't.
Yes, you can.
Gary?
You better go.
Not till you say yes.
No, I can't.
Yes, you can.
I can't.
Gary?
Yes, you can.
Will you please go?
Not till you say yes.
Why is this so important to you?
I don't know. Maybe because, you like my poem.
Gary?
Okay,
I'll go. Good, I'll pick you up at 8 o'clock. Okay.
And he could almost be Carrie if she were popular, in a way, because there's nothing mean-spirited about him. It's
right.
Kind of pure in a way.
Exactly.
Yeah. And I think another thing, people are so focused on the bravura kind of filmmaking, the camera work in De Palma's films, that they tend to overlook the performances because they're just so wowed by that other thing. But, and also, he's not necessarily going for realism,
right.
Realistic performances.
Right. I like to call it heightened realism. You know,
yeah.
It's sort of like one tick over realism. You know what I mean? It does have that artificial quality, and that's okay because for the vast sweep of movie history, movies were more artificial. If you go back and watch movies from the 30s and 40s, they're extremely artificial. You know, because a lot of those things. You know, we're based, you know, a lot of those actors came out of the stage or the directors came out of the stage, so that they were very stagey and artificial. Now, you can never say that about De Palma, but he arrives in, you know, the early 70s, which is sort of when artificiality is diminishing, you know, and naturalism is coming in. So, you know, he's a really interesting blend of those qualities, I think. But he's certainly more artificial than what we see now. I mean, today, you know, we're not allowed to have those kind of big moments. You know, people say they're cheesy or, like you said, over the top. You know, now, I mean, it really irks me. You know, anything that's made in the 70s, you read about on the Internet, and people say, oh, yeah, it's so cheesy, you know, so cheesy and campy. You know, and
yeah.
what they're really saying is that people had different haircuts in the 70s. You know, you know, I mean, that's what it really comes down to. You know, they see long hair on a guy, you know, like... you know, Dirk Benedict in Battlestar Galactica, and it's so cheesy.
It's outdated.
Yeah,
look at the haircuts.
Right, exactly. You know, I'm still waiting for, you know, the next release of the Star Wars movies where George Lucas will have digitally, you know, fixed Han Solo's haircuts.
Yeah.
But, you know,
giving him a haircut. Yeah.
Yeah, you know, it's just funny how we deride everything that looks like it was from the 70s as being campy or cheesy. I mean, anytime, you know, Battlestar Galactica, Space 1999, Star Wars, anything, it always has to be, you know, preceded by the word campy or cheesy.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's just silly. And I think that, you know, De Palma in some sense fits into that. You know, he's sort of a victim of his time in that, you know, people did have those haircuts in his movies, you know.
Okay, that's John Kenneth Muir and our conversation about Carrie. John will be back throughout the week to talk Dress to Kill, Blowout, and Raising Kane with us. So, Jerry, your impressions of any of those observations that John made?
Oh, wow. I mean, where do I even start? First of all, I wish you, you know, William Catt, always wish he was on our show. We tried. I know we did try. And there's a funny story behind that too. But
the cat eludes us.
Yes, the cat does. I like, you know, what's you know, that's a good point he brings out. Everything from the 70s is like the precursors is campy or dated or something. Well, that's the time that it was made. I mean,
mm-hmm.
All right, don't look beyond that. I mean, there's so much great stuff there. You're right about Lucas, though. He would digitally alter all that stuff, go back.
And then also the tone of De Palma's films. I can't remember. I don't think maybe we did discuss it last night with John. I can't remember which interview clip it's in, but the tone of De Palma's films being operatic, and that's not something that you see. Yeah, we did talk about it last night.
Mm-hmm.
That's not something you see
anymore, and you hear the word opera and operatic associated with De Palma a lot.
Right.
You see, you see gore fests, you see things that are over the top, but it's a special kind of tone, and it's something that De Palma has mastered. Maintaining that operatic tone where everything is so heightened
mm-hmm.
to like the highest, a high pitch, and yet it's not in a laughable way. Other directors would probably crumble, and you'd laugh at the excess,
right?
In a negative sense. And this one, if you laugh at it, it's just because it makes you giddy. I mean, it's infectious.
Well, there is all the films we're talking about this week. The third acts are infectious, as you're right, giddy. They're all like over the top. I mean, and look, he keeps that going in the Black Dahlia. I mean, the second half of the Black Dahlia is just like over the top madness.
Yeah.
And I won't lie to you, I always enjoy that when it's on. I know it's not like the greatest movie in the world, but it's a lot of fun to watch. I won't lie to you, but this character.
You know, I can imagine. Hold that thought. I can imagine because I haven't really enjoyed Black Dahlia, and I thought it was such a perfect project for De Palma.
Mm-hmm.
I can imagine returning to that movie multiple times throughout the years and finally getting it.
Mm-hmm.
Because I guess I'm a little slow on the uptake with Black Dahlia. And maybe it was the fact that I expected and wanted it to be a different movie than what
it
is.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, look, it's not a perfect movie by any stretch of the imagination, but it's all the stuff that we're talking about is there. It's all there. But it brings up something. Cary is, at the end of the day, like you said, it's a very good point about you feel like you're watching a John Hughes film. I mean, that's it. You take out the telekinesis, there's a lot of there's a lot of truth in that statement.
It's a great adolescent horror movie.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it's about the horror of adolescence in a way that is as effective as anything that John Hughes made.
Yeah, and let's be honest, if you want to go that far, another influence, if you really want to go ahead, Welcome to the Dollhouse.
Yeah, yeah.
Don't you see? I mean, there's a lot of Cary in there.
Actually, Cary was... For background on Cary, I mean, it was his first Stephen King novel.
Mm-hmm.
He had been living off of, well, not really living off of it. He and his family were broke off of selling short stories, the most of which he got paid $500 for a short story. That was
right.
The most he ever got paid for his writing.
Right.
So he was writing Cary, and it turning out to be longer than a short story. So he threw it away, and as you know, it's been told often, his wife pulled it out of the trash and read it and said, "This is good. You need to do this."
Mm-hmm.
And so they sold it for an advance of $2,500 from Doubleday, which they took
mm-hmm.
because they needed the money. And surprising to him, it sold like mad. And the paperback check was $400,000, of
right.
which he got half. So that was a big success for his first novel, and unusual for a first novel in that it followed a female character. It was a male
right.
author writing about a female character, and he felt like Cary. He was expressing outrage
mm-hmm.
Because he knew what it was like to be an outcast.
Right.
So all of that, just he was working with great source material, De Palma was. I mean, it's all there in the book. Underneath the horrific elements of it, there's that, that outcast that just can't... And I know that from my personal life growing up.
We all do, I think, to an extent. That's what makes Cary so identifiable. You can relate to it. There's no doubt about that. I mean, I finally read the book. They reissued it in 2000. I remember I bought and read it. It was... Yeah, great. I could really identify with a good chunk of it. And the same with the movie. I mean, who doesn't? Like you said, anyone who's been through high school, the trials and tribulations of high school is going to identify with that story.
Yeah. And I think that's why people keep returning to it. Because when I look at De Palma films, most of them, like Sisters, like this one, and we brought it up to Edward Pressman last night, you can imagine them being completely campy, exploitative kind of films.
Mm-hmm.
You can imagine Carrie being done as complete schlock.
Right.
But
well, that's the sequel. That sequel.
Yeah, but you don't have to imagine it. Just
yeah,
watch the sequel.
Go watch. Just go watch that. I don't even know what. I know Amy Irving was in that, wasn't she?
Was she in the sequel? I'm not sure.
I'll have to look that up. But I think
I did not check out the sequel.
You didn't miss anything. It was a
yeah.
I mean, you really didn't miss anything.
The Rage or something. I mean,
yeah,
you know,
Rage. Yeah.
And that was released what, like 10, 12 years ago.
That was I think 1999. I think it was released.
Okay. I mean, today they would just remake Carrie.
Yeah. Oh God, I don't want to even think about that, but.
No, I don't either. But I wouldn't be surprised if that's coming around the bend.
Yeah, you got a point there. Oh God.
I mean, because that's a classic movie, name recognition. I mean, I'm sure they're going to mind that. But just like Sisters, Carrie could have been, you know, just another horror film,
mm-hmm.
as we've seen from Stephen King movies. In the years that followed, I mean, good books, good source material, many of them, most
mm-hmm.
of them, that didn't make for great movies because they didn't have someone with vision enough to realize their full potential on screen.
Mm-hmm.
And with Carrie, for the first time I see De Palma's visual virtuosity matched by an artist's sensitivity.
Mm-hmm.
And I mean, it's evident, and, you know, Piper Laurie was nominated, Sissy Spacek was nominated for a genre film that never gets nominated,
yeah,
you know?
Very true.
So when people talk about performances in De Palma films, I mean, and, you know, Paul Hirsch at the end of the week, one of the interviews that we're going to feature for Raising Kane, he says, you know, the best actors do De Palma's films, but strangely, they rarely, if ever, give their best performances in a De Palma film. That's a quote from him during the interview. And my argument is, you know, for instance, what about Carrie? Just
yeah.
as one example. I mean, a great early performance from Sissy Spacek. I mean, obviously she's great in Badlands. She's
right,
and she's got so many great performances under her belt. But Carrie
right.
is really. Iconic, and I'll even read new interviews with Sissy Spacek when she was doing press for Get Low, and several reporters were like, "Do you mind if I ask you about Carrie?" You know, and Piper Laurie. I mean, who could forget that performance?
Yeah, that's God. I mean, and that's the mother. I mean, she's insane. I mean, you see where it all comes from. I mean, you really do feel for Carrie because she's going from one battle zone to another. I mean, there's no safe
yeah.
place for her. Home is just as dangerous as high school.
Once again, different layers at work, because Piper Laurie read that script,
mm-hmm.
and she knew the humor of it.
Mm-hmm.
So you have a relationship between them that is horrifying. At the same time, it's moving and sad.
Mm-hmm.
And at the same time, it's very funny.
Yeah, there's definitely humor, yeah, and there's no doubt about that.
How many film directors can dramatize so many emotions in a single scene? I mean, it's all there. You're kind of conflicted watching some of his movies.
Yeah,
you know?
That's very true.
There's just so much to chew on. So let's get to our second interview for the night for this show. I was talking about who can forget Piper Laurie. Who can forget Nancy Allen in Carrie? She played Chris, the sexy and vicious girlfriend of John Travolta.
Yeah.
And she was also in Dress to Kill and Blowout for De Palma. And she'll be featured on those shows as well tomorrow night and Thursday night. And she was also in De Palma's film Home Movies, which we discuss more at length with Keith Gordon during tomorrow night's show as well. And she was married to De Palma during this period as well. But throughout her impressive career, she was also featured in Spielberg's 1941 and Hal Ashby's The Last Detail, and probably most memorably as Officer Ann Lewis in the RoboCop trilogy, which actually she has some really interesting things to say about the RoboCop trilogy.
Yes, she does.
That's Thursday Night Show. For tonight, though, we focus on those early days leading up to and including her experiences on Carrie. So here is Nancy Allen. Prior to Carrie, I understand that you moved out to L.A. and decided to work on becoming an actress after you had a small role in The Last Detail, right?
Yes, that's correct. I had been living and working in New York and doing commercials for 10 years, and I was cast in The Last Detail, and I thought, you know, this is, you know, I really need to go deeper into my acting, but it was a few more years before I actually made the move.
Mm-hmm.
That was step two, and then I didn't move to L.A. till September of 75.
A couple of years later, I guess the audition opportunity for Carrie came about.
Yes.
And I know it was done in conjunction with the Star Wars auditions, which you missed out on because you showed up on the last day of auditions.
Yes.
For Carrie.
Yeah, I had an agent that didn't do anything. I mean, I didn't have any auditions or anything, and I happened to run into Harriet Helberg, who was the casting director, and she had known me back in New York, back in the days of commercials, and she was a big company called Horn Griner. They directed a lot of commercials at that time, and she ran into me and said, oh, I'm casting this film, it's the last day, you won't get the part, but at least you'll meet at least you'll meet a new and upcoming director. And I went, oh, great, that's great. So I went over to her office, I picked up the script, I went to the library, got the book, I stayed up all night, I read both, I wrote a biography of the character, you know,
wow.
Everything. It was, and I was the last person on the last day of casting.
Mm.
So that was great for me, you know, really.
Tell me about that character. Had you, in Carrie, had you known girls like that in high school? Because she's pretty vicious.
Yeah, they
at times.
Well, I certainly knew that girls could be mean. I would say that I didn't really know anyone exactly like her because in high school I was in performing arts for a couple mm-hmm. years, and then I went to a professional school. So people were kind of already on their path and working, so that wasn't a normal high school setting. So I think I let the inner vicious me channel through.
If I understand correctly, with Mr. De Palma and the cast, how was that helpful to you, and what occurred during those rehearsals?
Well, it was actually a week, and everybody came together. Pretty much everybody was there, with the exception of John and Sissy. And what we did, it was really brilliant on his part. What he did was he constructed these little theater games and these improvisations, and we had to. The first setup, as I recall, was to have a high school elect a president of the class. So everybody had to campaign from their character's point of view. So
wow.
That really kind of got you into, you know, your role right away, just sort of thinking about, gee, what would my character say? And what would my character do? And you got to really meet all these ensemble players who you were going to be working with and get a glimpse of who they were. So it was really, I thought, very clever on his part
to
do that.
Yeah, that really is.
Yeah.
And did a lot come from improvisation, those improvisations that made it into the film at all?
Well, I think, no. I mean, we really were on script, but what came was the relationships and the characters were formed, and you really got who everybody was, and it bonded us in that way, and I thought that was really, for me, the most useful, and that was, what was hard for me was that I was a little bit shy, and or mm-hmm. was then, and other than from my character's point of view or when I was speaking lines, I didn't really talk to anybody, so everybody just assumed I was this horrible human being, and they didn't really like me. Nobody really talked to me until about a week into shooting. I guess I did a good job. I don't know.
Tell me about working with De Palma as a director, because he's viewed obviously as a master technical director. But how does he relate to the actors? How does he work with them?
Well, I thought he worked quite well, and he had specific ideas. He'd see the scene, he'd give you a little direction. You could try things. I mean, he really, I think, used his actors in the best way possible. So you had a lot of time to explore. You got to do a lot of takes. A lot of actors don't like that, but I actually do. I enjoy trying things that way, and I think most of the other actors really enjoyed working with him as well on that film. We were really lucky. I mean, it was pretty much everybody's almost first film, certainly first significant role in a film, with the exception of Sissy, who had done
Badlands,
and then there was a movie that she had done with Lee Marvin. I can't.
Oh yeah, Prime Cut.
Prime Cut. Yeah.
Yeah. I remember.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, but she wasn't part of the gang at that point. So you know what I mean. He's real good with actors.
Was this a project that was buzzed about? I mean, this was a best-selling novel. Could you feel that there was a buzz about it as you were making it and as it was being released?
No, I didn't feel any buzz. I wasn't aware of the book before. I guess it was popular with high school kids, and I really wasn't a high school kid anymore, but I didn't know about the book. The only buzz was on the set was that everybody was really excited. I mean, it's a kind of a cool thing when it's everybody's first film. I mean, it was, here you are on this film. Everybody's excited. Everybody would come every day, whether they were working or not. And the fact that he invited us to see the dailies, I remember that first week going. So it was like we were all kind of coming up together. It was a very exciting project to be working on. So I think we all knew it was going to be good, but I don't know that there was much sense, at least I was not even thinking about the movie opening. I was just thinking about making the movie, you know, and how lucky we were, and it was really an exciting time, you know. We were getting paid nothing, basically, scale, plus 10%. We were working for, which was really like $600 a week then.
Right.
And, you know, but we were all thrilled to be there every second.
Right.
Yeah. With these three films that we're covering, Carrie and Dress to Kill and Blowout, there's such a sense of opera to them, to all of De Palma's thrillers. And I'm curious about your relationship as an actor with the De Palma's camera. I mean, with his camera work, it's so energetic. When you watch a movie, can you feel that, and do you feed off that as an actor while you're doing it?
Well, I would say that's interesting. I was just having this conversation with I was at a film festival, and I was having this conversation with the director. We were talking about, you know, directors now that sit and watch the video, you know, the playback, and standing by the camera. I think that, yes, and you have to have a relationship with that camera because you're working in concert. It's like it's the silent partner, really. You always have to be aware of where it is, what you're doing, what they're seeing. I always, you know, you have to have a sense of that. So it's like a dance, if you will. And at least for me, that's what it feels like. Sometimes, I mean, you're unaware. It's not like you're constantly conscious, but you also have to have that that piece of you that's conscious of where it is as a whole, all the time. So sometimes because of the way he would shoot things, it was a little bit difficult because if the camera was moving and things were timed, you might have to pause and respond in a moment or a way that seemed unrealistic, but you know, you trust, having seen the films, you'd know that it would be fine
right.
in the outcome. So it's I guess of course you have to be in relationship to that camera, sure.
Well, there is that aspect of the great performances from his films and yours included, in that it's not necessarily absolute naturalism that you guys seem to be going after. It's a kind of a heightened realism.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it's of course it's dramatic, and I think especially with thrillers or suspense, all of that. I mean, movie making is all you know, fantasy to some degree, but there's really less boundaries, there's really less limits when you work within that genre, within a genre film, because it's, you know, you can almost go anywhere and do anything you want to do, and it doesn't really have to be completely realistic.
Yeah.
It can stretch those boundaries.
Okay, that's our first part of our Nancy Allen interview centered around Carrie and her early working experiences with De Palma. Nancy will be back and she'll talk at greater length about Dress to Kill and Blowout tomorrow night. Yeah, there's some real highlights.
Yeah, this is really good, and it's a really awesome. She's a sweet girl and just
terrific.
Awesome to talk to. I mean, it was really one of those interviews. We started to talk to her, then she had to go to the vet for her dog, and then she called back. It was a very interesting day.
She was very accommodating and so sweet, so sweet to us, and very candid, and it made for a terrific interview. So that's something to look forward to for the rest of the week for you guys.
It is.
Also, this was the first movie. I wanted to mention something else. I don't want to give away everything in Paul Hirsch's interview, but
we do
talk about the split screen device. And Paul Hirsch has made it clear in previous interviews that he never liked the split screen because he felt that it was more of an intellectual device than an emotional one.
Mm-hmm.
And his feelings on it was that it couldn't help but take you out of the experience a little bit.
Oh, interesting. Okay.
The studio, the reason why I bring this up is the studio, when De Palma shot Carrie, he always devised the split screen. That's the way he shot it. So the studio hated the split screen. So he said, finally, after back and forth, he said, all right, to Paul, he said, do what you can with it.
Mm-hmm.
And so that entire sequence was supposed to be split screen. But as it is now, there are just sections of it that are. The sections that they could not help but use split screen was because there were ladders and lighting equipment that was visible off the center frame.
Right.
Because they were devised for split screen. I mean, they were devised only to use a certain portion of the frame. What's your take on that, the split screen that De Palma utilizes?
I've never seen anything like it before. I find it fascinating. I think that's what we talk about, is that visual trademark, because it just adds to it. I think I agree with Dean in the chat room. It enhances the experience. He's absolutely right. It's just one of those visual tricks that I associate with him, and I think it makes Carrie all the more memorable. I can't imagine watching it without it, and God forbid there ever is a remake. I doubt anyone would be able to pull it. I don't think anyone could pull it off the way he does.
No. I mean, it seems like under anyone else's direction other than De Palma's, it would seem like an outdated kind of device. I mean, it might have seemed outdated then. I mean, it's something relegated usually to Annette Funicello movies, where she's talking on the phone with her boyfriend, and there's a split screen, and you see the boyfriend on the other end. And,
yeah.
You know, something like that. But for De Palma, first of all,
I think it's efficient. I mean, you look at Sisters.
Mm-hmm.
You always follow Margot Kidder and William Finley as they're cleaning up the apartment, while downstairs the detectives are having a conversation with the neighbor that calls them in
right.
to go up to the apartment.
Mm-hmm.
So it's a very effective and efficient device. I never find that my attention is diverted where it doesn't need to be. I with the De Palma split screens, I always feel equally attentive to both sides of the frame.
Yeah, and you see that in, I mean, the one movie that comes to mind is the, God, what's the name of that movie from 1999 to 2000, Mike Figgis movie. You know what I'm talking about, with the four screens.
Yeah. Timeline or something, or
no, Timeline is the one, the one the Richard Donner thing based.
Yeah. But it's Time something, isn't it?
Yeah, I think so. But you know, you see that. I mean, you even see it. God, I'll go here. Just the expectations versus reality sequence in 500 Days of Summer. Those two, you know, that's, you know, I can't imagine. I mean, I think De Palma's influence is far greater than a lot of people will let on. But the technical, it's there. I mean, in the oddest places, but it is there.
Dean says Time Code. Dean is our trivia guru in the chat room today.
He's a cinematic encyclopedia. He knows everything. So we go to him. He's better than anything else. He really is.
Yeah, but, and also what it does with Carrie, I think Carrie reaches a point where you're so completely invested and involved in the experience of it that this split screen cannot lessen that
right.
investment by the time it comes to the crescendo of the movie. And
right.
what it does is it really, so much more effective than just cutting.
Mm-hmm.
It keeps you at all times with Carrie because you're with her at all times in the movie, really. For the most part.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So you see her, and then you see all the havoc that she's causing on the other half of the frame.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's a kind word for it, yeah.
And it's terrifying. I mean, that blank, concentrated look on her face with mm-hmm. the eyes wide open, covered in blood. And I love that. I love the split screen. And it's not just... There's part of me that loves it, the film geek in me.
Mm-hmm.
Says, oh, that's so cool, that's neat, that's such a unique way of visualizing the sequence. But the other part of me, I think it does work on an emotional level.
Yeah, no.
You see, it's cause and effect. It's right
yeah,
there.
I can't think of his films, a lot of his films, I can't imagine it not being the split screen. They're
yeah.
hard to... It's hard to think of without that. It's a great device that he uses. And I think he's the only one that can get away with it, really, in the end.
And by the way, the entire sequence is great. I mean, but leading up to the pig blood dropping on her, you know, the dance that they do and the cameras encircling mm-hmm. she and William Cat to dizzying effect, and that's an important moment for Carrie. I mean. And the camera makes you feel what Carrie must feel. I mean,
yeah.
Dizzy. This is a whirlwind. This is a dream moment for her.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Which makes the downfall just so much more devastating.
Oh, yeah.
It really is one of the most emotional, scary movies I've ever seen.
Mm-hmm. I'll give you that, definitely. There's nothing cold about it. There's nothing cold about a De Palma film, that's for sure.
Yeah, well, and yet people...
Well, that's because it's this whole thing, you know, he just doesn't get the respect. He really doesn't.
Yeah.
It's sad. It's something very sad. We've talked about that many times before, but it's very true.
And Carrie is another example when people say that he makes cold, kind of clinical feeling movies. Carrie is the number one that I'll bring out. You know,
mm-hmm.
Casualties of War is another. I mean, that's a wounding movie. That's like you feel like you've been punched in the heart
yeah.
when you watch Casualties of War.
That's very true.
And also, Carrie marked a special place in De Palma's career also because it was his first collaboration with Pino Donaggio, his composer that followed him through a lot of these films.
Mm-hmm.
He wanted to use Bernard Herrmann. Bernard Herrmann was going to do it, and then I think he passed on before he was able to, so he went to Pino. And, man, these scores, these elegant, beautiful, sweeping, romantic scores
mm-hmm. mm-hmm.
Are just phenomenal.
They are, without.
And actually, most famously, prior to Carrie, he composed Don't Look Now, which in the annals of 70s horror cinema stands tall.
Yeah, that does. That stands very tall. That's a crazy film. Oh, my God.
Yeah, yeah. So we're going to end tonight's show with Pino's score from Carrie.
Oh, cool.
It's very romantic, delicate, you know, and it's such a haunting kind of quality to it. Tomorrow night, Dress to Kill. This is a packed show tomorrow night, full 2 hours at least, with John Kenneth Muir and Nancy Allen returning. Keith Gordon will be with us, as will producer George Leto. Great, funny guy, George Leto.
Yeah, cool.
And great passion he has, so for film. And we really look forward to bringing you all those interviews tomorrow night. Tomorrow night, 10 p.m. Eastern, Dress to Kill. All right, Jerry.
All right. This is an awesome show. And, we'll see you all back here tomorrow night.
By the way, De Palma a la Mode is the place for all the great latest news on Brian De Palma. They've been running. They're running a series of articles based on our interviews and our shows throughout the week, and he's just been great to us. He has a great website there. He's a great writer. He's a devoted De Palma fanatic.
We love
him, and we really appreciate the coverage that he's providing us for this series of shows.
Yes, we do.
All right, here's Pino. We'll see you guys tomorrow night. Good night, Jerry.
Good night. No, I was waiting for the score, like Dean was waiting for the score.
I'm sorry. I keep teasing the score. Okay.
Teasing us, man.
All right. See you tomorrow night, guys.
See
bye-bye.
You, man. Good night.